Hey, it's Joe. I'm sure you're aware the paleo diet burst onto the scene over 20 years ago. I recall it was very appealing to me. It had a natural appeal. But it also had the problem of determining what exactly did our ancestors eat, and can we still get those things? The arguments continue to this day. And of course, any good idea gets its share of fast followers. A bunch of variations on the whole ancestral diet thing have emerged since then to muddy the waters even more. The real paleo diet isn't about meat-heavy or protein-heavy macronutrient splits or prohibitions against eating anything in moderation. It really is a very simple prescription for creating a starting place for each of us to determine our own personal diet that works for our own individual physiology and goals. Today I chat with Trevor Connor, ex-elite cyclist and CEO of the Paleo Diet Company, which was founded by Dr. Lauren Codane, the originator of the paleo diet, author of the Paleo Diet book, and who was Trevor's professor at Colorado State University. So listen in as Trevor explains how the paleo diet has continued to evolve over the last 20 years as more research has come to light, as well as Trevor's personal experience in using the paleo diet to extend his racing career by reducing his inflammation and speeding his recovery from exercise. It's a good story, and Trevor shares a ton of useful details that we can all use for our own efforts to become healthier, stronger athletes. All right, let's talk to Trevor Connor. Trevor Connor, welcome to the Wise Athletes Podcast.
Joe, thanks for having me. I've been looking forward to this.
Yeah, me too. I wanted to first say, in addition to thank you for coming onto the podcast, was to say that I'm a longtime fan of your Fast Talk podcast.
Oh, you listen. Appreciate that.
Your podcast, Fast Talk, was the very first podcast I ever listened to regularly. Back, you know, some years ago, I was racing in Colorado on my bike a lot, and you guys were the source, man. You knew, you had all the advice, all the information that people like me who just wanted to get better but didn't really know what to do, you guys had it all. So thanks for that. Appreciate it.
I really appreciate that. I'm glad it had a good impact for you.
Yeah. Okay, so today we're going to learn some more, or I'm going to learn some more. We're going to talk about the paleo diet, and I actually remember you talking a lot about that here and there on the Fast Talk podcast. So it's been interesting me sort of getting ready for our talk today, and I'm definitely looking forward to learning more about it. I mean, of course, everybody's heard of the paleo diet. You know, I mean, it kind of blew up. It became the thing, you know, like in the 20 teens. The book, I think, was The Paleo Diet, early 2000, Dr. Cordain, who you know.
So he was my thesis advisor in college.
Right. So give us your story here. What's your backstory with the paleo diet and your connection to Dr. Cordain and that book?
Yeah. So, I mean, the ironic thing was I arrived at CSU where he was a professor. I was the only TA there who had never heard of Dr. Cordain. Literally, like my second day there, everybody was talking about the guy they called the serial killer. So not S-E-R-I-A-L, cereal as in breakfast cereal. Because he had done an interview talking about one of the breakfast cereals and saying how bad it was for you. Right. And I just went, what are you guys talking about? And they said, oh, you haven't heard of the paleo diet? And I went, no, what's that? And his course was a requirement for people in the master's program. And I had spent 10 years studying traditional sports nutrition. So I took his course, and it actually made me angry because it was in the face of everything that I had learned, to the point that I took the course in the spring. I spent the summer trying to prove him wrong. Just going through the science, going, this can't be right. This doesn't make sense. And so I was going through the science. You know, I go, well, it's got to be wrong about this. And I go and find what I could in the science. Go, well, actually, he's kind of got a point there. And then I go, but he's going to be wrong about this. And then I go research that and then go, well, damn, he's got a point there. And what happened was, as I was reading this, I go, well, this makes sense, that makes sense. I was slowly going paleo, and I didn't even know it. And I was, sorry, I'm probably telling you a very long story, but I was 38 at the time. I had retired from being a full-time cyclist because I was just having illness issues. I was struggling to recover all that and just figured, well, it's age.
Right.
And that winter, even though I was a full-time student, I had a coaching business, all these things going on. I was training better than I had in years. I was just recovering really well. I wasn't getting sick. That summer, I went to Canadian Nationals. I was broken away most of the race in third place, and Seth cut right on the line to finish like 10th, but very close to the podium at Canadian Nationals on my 39th birthday.
Impressive.
And next year, I just said, well, let's give it another go. Joined the team, did a full race calendar, was briefly ranked top 10 in the country, and all that was the Paleo Diet. So I was doing all that at 40.
Well, that's a good story, and no doubt led to you being committed to it. I mean, the results speak for themselves.
Well, it sold me. It sold me because I was skeptical. I didn't believe it at first, and it was really reading the science where I went, yeah, he's got a point here. And unfortunately, a lot of people see it as a fad diet. The Paleo Diet is a very catchy name, which kind of lends itself to fad diets. But I always love to tell people, when Dr. Cordain wrote that first book, his original title was A More Natural Human Diet Based on Ethnographic Paleolithic Data.
Not very catchy.
No, the publishers just went, no. And they also said, so he had submitted the first four chapters, and they went, you have to go rewrite all this. This is just a giant science review. Nobody will read this.
That's funny. Well, hey, why don't we, just in case people have heard of it but don't really know what it is, you know, why don't you give us a little bit of a background? Maybe you can distinguish the Paleo Diet from all these other things that have cropped up over the years, you know, Primal Blueprint and Neanderthin and Pagan and Carnivore. You know, what is the Paleo Diet? How is it different from these other things? And, you know, everybody's got to make their own little spin on it, or they can't sell it, right?
Yeah.
But then compare it then to something that maybe people would have a better understanding of, like a Mediterranean diet. You know, what's different?
So I think a starting point for this is you have to understand the context in which we're studying research right now. If you ask me, as somebody who's been studying nutrition for decades, to design the most unhealthy diet possible that doesn't immediately put you in the hospital, uh-huh, I would design something pretty close to a very Western diet.
Sure.
We fast eat that. Yeah, a very heavily processed, very nutrient-poor diet. So when you are starting with something like that, almost any change is going to be better. And this is why people struggle. So they'll show you studies. Go, we took people who were on a classic Western diet, and we put them on a vegan diet, and they got healthier. We put them on a Mediterranean diet, they got healthier. We put them on a carnivore diet, they got better. So you can find evidence for all these diets. And that gets really confusing to people. But the way I explain it to people, it's from a sports perspective. If you take a couch potato who has been doing no exercise whatsoever for the last 5 years, and you have them do anything, they're going to see improvements.
Yeah.
That's a very different question from what is optimal for an Olympic athlete. You can take somebody off the couch, give them a very bad training plan, and they're going to improve. You can't do that with an Olympic athlete. And that's, when I'm in the nutrition world looking at the research, that's what I'm looking for, is you have somebody who's eating a decent diet. What is optimal for health? When you get them past that, let's get you off of Doritos and all these really unhealthy foods. You're eating a decent diet. What now is optimal? And that's very different science. And Dr. Cordain's approach to it that was very appealing to me was saying, if you start the research with people on a Western diet, you're going to have a very hard time answering that question of what is optimal. So let's start with the bias of we evolved around a certain diet. We evolved around certain foods. Let's start there and then do the research on how to optimize that. So the whole idea of the Paleo Diet is simply, what were the foods that we evolved around? Now let's mimic that. We can't eat exactly that. Most of those foods don't exist. But what we know is that for millions of years while we were evolving, we ate lots of fruits, vegetables, you know, healthier meats, fish, nuts, and seeds, and they were minimally processed. So start with that as a diet, and then let's do the research on that and see the impacts. So you brought up a lot of those kind of crazier fad diets. The issues with those are, again, if they get you on something that's a little more nutrient dense, if they get you on fruits and vegetables, maybe some healthier meats, you're going to see improvements right away. people are going to talk about it on social media and say, oh, I felt better, all this sort of stuff. But that's just getting you off the couch. The question is that really going to help you in the long run? I love that you brought up the Mediterranean diet. What you are now seeing in the research, again, when you're talking about that optimizing, the diets that are performing the best are the ones that focus more on what are the foods that you should be eating as opposed to other factors. A lot of the diets really focus on macronutrient ratio. Should you be eating high carb, low carb, high fat, low fat, high protein, low protein? I don't believe in that approach. I can give you a high carbohydrate diet that's pretty good for you. I can give you a high carbohydrate diet that's really bad for you. Same thing with fats, same things with proteins. It's not the way to look at diet. Mediterranean diet is a diet that says, what are the foods you should be eating? Paleo is a diet that says, what are the foods that you should be eating? So a lot of people go, oh, that's that super high protein diet, anti-carb diet. No, we don't tell you what protein ratio to eat. We don't tell you what carbohydrate ratio to eat. We tell you what foods we think are healthy and what foods we think aren't healthy. And final answer to your question, I kind of listed for you what the paleo diet foods are. It's the fruits, vegetables, naturally grown meats, fish, and then nuts and seeds sparingly. What's controversial about the diet is we really say you need to limit grains. You need to limit or not drink dairy. And if you have conditions, you really need to eliminate or reduce legumes.
Okay, for the layperson, that's a bean.
Basically beans, yep.
Okay, so it's like a Mediterranean diet minus grains, beans, and dairy.
Yeah, we're very similar. We actually, Dr. Cordain and I wrote a whole article where we took a Mediterranean diet and just replaced their grains, their legumes with more paleo foods and actually demonstrated that doing that, the paleo version of the diet became more nutrient dense. But they're pretty similar. We didn't have to replace that much.
Got it.
But, you know, something we're proud of, there was a meta-analysis that recently came out that was put out by a group in Australia. And this is a group that put out pretty anti-paleo research in the past. And they analyzed studies on most of the popular diets, including the Mediterranean and the DASH diet, which are the most recommended diets right now, and looked at their impacts on markers of chronic disease. So inflammatory markers, markers of diabetes, things like that. And compared the different diets, and the paleo diet came out number one.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, they were not happy about it. You read the discussion; they're like trying to go, "Well, this is what we found, but boy, we don't want to believe this."
Oh, awesome! Well, so let me ask you, and let's focus on the things that are excluded. Mm-hmm. And I guess that the idea is that these things didn't exist as food for human beings 10,000 and earlier years ago.
Yeah.
So what other basis, like proof that these things are unhealthy, grains and dairy and beans, you know, more than just, well, they weren't there, so we couldn't have evolved to eat them?
So let's start with grains, particularly wheat. My thesis with Dr. Cordain was on the impact of wheat on autoimmune disease. And it actually, I mean, we put our energy into this. I'm glad I was kind of ignorant to what it was going to take when I agreed to do this with them, because I ended up staying at CSU an additional 2 years. I had to basically take a whole year of immunology classes just to prepare myself to write this thesis. And first thing I will tell you, you know, before I started working with Dr. Cordain, I was one of those people who was saying, oh, this whole gluten-free thing is ridiculous. There's zero research behind that. Anybody who says that, send them my way. I've probably read 300 studies.
And what do they say?
Stop me when I start going into too much detail. But here's the starting point. All life likes to protect itself. Uh-huh. Animals can run away or they can fight. Plants don't have that ability. So they look for other ways to defend themselves or to reproduce. When you're dealing with fruit, it's a really nice symbiotic relationship. The plants have this very tasty, nutrient-dense food around a seed that's indigestible. So they actually want you to eat the fruit because you'll eat it, you'll eat the seeds, you'll then go somewhere else away from the parent plant and deposit the seed elsewhere with some nice fertilizer, and that works really well. So there isn't a lot of anti-nutrients in fruit. But when you're dealing with grains, the way they have built their defense mechanisms is with all their anti-nutrients. So if you went and ate raw wheat, or even if you ate raw beans, you would get violently sick. And in nature, an animal might eat one grain plant or one wheat plant, get very sick, and have that immediate reaction, go, okay, yeah, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to avoid that plant because I didn't like the reaction to it before. And that's how they defend themselves. And I'll go, if you'd like, into some of the details of these anti-nutrients.
I think that what the distinction between the fruit and the grains, and maybe the beans also, is that the fruit is this pulpy thing that has sugars in it, and it tastes good. And the idea is you'll eat that and swallow the seeds, but not digest them. But the grains and the beans are the seeds. And so the plant doesn't right. want you to eat the seeds, because that's what it's using to procreate itself.
Exactly. So if you eat that wheat plant, it's not going to reproduce. If you are eating the seeds, and you're going to break them down, and you're not going to deposit them somewhere else to grow. So the wheat plant does not want you to eat it, does not want you to eat the reproductive material. And so it has a lot of anti-nutrients in it that are really designed to make us sick. And the issue that we have is we've kind of tricked ourselves. By processing the wheat plant or a lot of these grains and cooking them, you get most of the anti-nutrients out. So as a result, you don't eat it and get violently sick. One of the debates, one of the arguments in the science, is whether it gets rid of all the anti-nutrients. And that's been pretty much resolved. No, you don't. You have most of it's gone, like 90, 95% of it's gone, but there is a small amount that remains. And as a result, we're basically doing this very, very minor poisoning of ourselves that takes a very long time to have an impact on our body. So I don't know if you've ever read the work of Dr. Hans Selye.
No.
So he was a kind of revolutionary researcher in physiology and medical sciences back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. He's actually the person who took the term stress, that was just an engineering term, and applied it to biology and applied it to psychology. But back in the 30s and 40s, he wrote what was called the generalized adaptation syndrome, wrote about it, which is this, he discovered that when you're dealing with people, or most of his research was with rats, that whenever you put a stressor on the body, there's kind of a common response. So that initially there's an alarm response, like you put somebody in a cold environment, or I hate to say it, the ethics of this are questionable now. But he would take rats and give them very small quantities of poison that in large quantities would kill them. Mm-hmm. But you just give them very small quantities. And what you would see is an initial alarm reaction. Your heart rate would go up. Blood pressure would go up. You'd see a release of sugars into the bloodstream. A whole bunch of responses. That would last a short period of time. And then your body would figure out how to respond. Main way was to release catecholamine. And then you would go into this stage of resistance or adaptation, where the body would seem to be able to handle this and would go on looking normally. But that stage of resistance, you'd keep the catecholamines elevated. Over time, you would reach a point of fatigue. And then all the symptoms of the alarm phase would come back. And then you would see what he called diseases of adaptation, which were things like high blood pressure, diabetes, heart disease. And if you didn't remove the stressor, in his case, with the studies he was doing with rats, the rats would die. And so one of the theories here is we're doing a very similar thing, that we're having a very mild toxin that we're constantly exposing our bodies to. We go into that stage of adaptation or resistance. So everybody goes, well, I've been eating wheat for years and I'm fine. It doesn't seem to affect me. But same thing, eventually you'll reach a fatigue state and you'll start seeing a disease state where these foods will have an impact on us, where you start seeing what he called them diseases of adaptation, we now call them diseases of civilization.
Interesting. I've heard in a different context about stress, and that there's good stress and bad stress. eustress and distress or something like that.
So he actually coined that term, eustress and distress on the body. Yep.
Awesome. So, awesome. So what I understood that to mean is that the eustress is still a stress on the body, but the body, it's low enough that the body can adapt to it and get stronger. It's like a hormetic effect kind of a thing.
Yeah.
And so I wonder if there isn't something to that, because, you know, you do studies of, you know, vegetarians, and mm-hmm. they always rank near the top, you know, of, you know, healthy diets, and, you know, they're eating grains and beans. So mm-hmm. I wonder if this anti-nutrient thing, you know, it sounds like marketing speak to me, but I wonder if it's a dose problem. You know, if you're just eating way too much of it, well, now it's a distress. It's too, your body can't yep. deal with it. Or maybe you've got other issues and this, and too much of this on top of that pushes you over the edge. But if you were just having a little bit and intermittently, not every single day, then maybe it's good for you. What do you think?
Well, so now you're getting to that whole idea of hormesis, that a large amount of something is very bad for you, but a small amount can be good for you. And again, the whole concept of hormesis came from a researcher who was looking at the effects of poisons on the body.
Right.
That you took a large amount of poison, and it would kill you, but a very small amount, and you adapt. So again, you know, this is where I thought Hans Selye's research was revolutionary, because it can take decades. But he basically said, yes, you adapt. You actually improve, but there is a point where your body fatigues and you go into a state of disease. And that's, you know, what we're seeing in Western civilization. You're seeing, once we're getting into our 50s, people start showing signs of disease. And we think this is natural aging. You know, heart disease, cancers, all these things in our 50s, 60s, we should just expect them. You look at studies of hunter-gatherer societies, and they were almost non-existent. And one of the myths is that, yeah, the hunter-gatherer societies, they all died of old age in their 40s. They didn't. You looked at modal age of death, which is the most common age of death. In hunter-gatherer societies, it was early 70s. Now, with all of our advanced medicine, you know, much more protected lifestyle, it's mid to, you know, kind of mid-70s, 75, 76, 77. We're not living that much longer. But what you saw back then is there was no disease until really a year or two before death. And then you'd see a rapid decline. We're now that age of what's called the age of morbidity, where you start seeing chronic disease. That's happening decades before age of mortality. And that's not actually a natural state for humans. Hmm. So you said it kind of sounds like marketing speak, but happy to dive into some of these anti-nutrients that you see. There's a ton of research on them and the impact that they have on the body. And that's really what I spent years diving into.
Well, what I'm driving at, mm-hmm. and I would like to talk more about it, is this idea of, do we really have to have none of these things?
No, and we don't actually promote that.
Okay. Well, that's useful to know. I'm not a vegetarian myself, mm-hmm. but you know, I have always, and the rationale was because I always have sort of been a believer in a higher protein intake to help me to recover from, you know, my varied and sometimes excessive, you know, use of my body. But I have always sort of had a soft spot in my heart for the people who ate a predominantly, you know, entirely or predominant plant-based diet, because there just seemed to be so much good that came from that. But I do think that there is something to be said for diversity and not overdoing things. And of course, you know, you go into the grocery store, you know, I read at one point that there was something like, oh, I can't even think of the number. You maybe even know it, but it was something like, you know, 100,000 different plants that ancient peoples had access to. And we now have like 300 that if you go into your grocery store, that's all there is, you know, and, you know, why is that? Well, there's probably lots of commercial economic reasons for it, but you know, we've even if you ate everything that was in the grocery store that was, you know, fresh, whole foods, you're not getting the diversity that our caveman ancestors did.
Right, and that's, you know, one of the issues that we've addressed, and it's one of the criticisms of the paleo diet. I fully agree with. Unfortunately, it's just not something we can do anything about. Yeah. There are, I think, great groups out there like Regenerative Organic, who are raising this issue and raising the issue of monocrops, where we, you know, we have huge fields that are just growing a single plant. And it's just a couple plants that are in our diet when we really should be having diversity. And again, it's been shown you have a much higher nutrient density in food when the fields are used for multi-purposes, when you're growing multiple plants on the fields. As a matter of fact, where you alternate the fields, where 1 year you grow crops on the field, and next year you grow animals on the field. That's going to increase nutrient density of our foods, and that we really should be going back to that direction. There is just this issue now that we are only eating a few plants and they're very nutrient poor. But look, I actually agree with you. And again, it goes back to that. You take somebody in a Western diet and get them to start eating some fruits and vegetables. Yes, they're going to be healthier. I will argue that a vegan diet is not as healthy as an omnivore diet. And there, this is not just a paleo perspective. I can send you tons of research showing similar trends that no, vegan diet is not the healthiest diet out there, that we are designed to be omnivores. But I'll admit to you, one of the things I really want to do is dive deeper into that research and come up with recommendations for vegans, because I admire them when they're doing it for ethical reasons, to help them eat as healthy a diet as possible. But they have to be careful. They need to supplement with B12. They need to supplement with B6. If you just eat a straight vegan diet, that actually can be bad for your health, particularly heart disease. You know, people think highest rates of heart disease are in North America. They're not. They're in India. India, for religious reasons, a lot of them are vegans, and that's causing high rates of heart disease.
I had not heard that. That's interesting.
Yeah. So that.
Okay.
No, sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to shift gears, so go ahead and wrap up if you had something to add.
Well, very quickly, I don't know how much you've talked on your show about the folate cycle.
None.
So that's a cycle that happens in our cells, and it requires folate, which you can get from plants and animals. It requires vitamin B6, which we can get from both, but the form of B6 that you get from plants, our bodies have a very hard time to use. So most of our B6 comes from animal food, and vitamin B12 is also required. And we can only get B12 from animal foods, particularly fish. And when we don't have enough B12 and we don't have enough B6, the folate cycle breaks down. And that has two important effects on us. One is it's responsible for DNA repair. So you don't see as effective a DNA repair. More importantly, when the cycle breaks down, we overproduce something called homocysteine. And you have everybody really concerned about the cholesterol levels in heart disease, but that's mostly been thrown out. Cholesterol doesn't have that big an impact in heart disease. Homocysteine has a very high correlation with heart disease. And that's what you see in vegans. If they're not supplementing with B6 and B12, they overproduce homocysteine, and that's leading to heart disease.
Another thing that seems to be missing is the omega-3s that, you know, you can get it in walnuts and things like that, but the body has a hard time converting it into EPA and DHA. So you're going to be short. You know, you do your omega index test. If you're a vegan, you're going to be on the low end of things. So yeah, I think that makes sense. And adding fish to a, you know, vegetarian or vegan diet, I think that's a great combination.
Yep.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about dairy before we move into some other things, because dairy is the other big one. You probably get a lot of complaints about, you know, you're stupid. Dairy is great for you. And I guess the argument is that we didn't, you know, milk elk or woolly mammoths. And so, you know, we're after, you know, nursing as a baby, then, you know, we didn't have milk. And of course, the lactase enzyme for being able to digest milk goes away. I am lactose intolerant.
Yep. Most people are.
And so I, you know, I don't drink milk. You know, I'd have to take lactase to, you know, not be sick from doing that. But I do eat Greek yogurt sometimes. I will admit, is that if I'm eating a lot of Greek yogurt all the time, I don't feel well. I think I have more inflammation in my body. And so I have recently cut way back on my Greek yogurt consumption. But some people are lactose and are tolerant of it. It persists. I guess that was an adaptation in the last 10,000 years that people maybe in northern climates where, you know, they had you know, hard time getting enough food in the wintertime, that they had these animals and they could get milk from these animals. And that would be a great source of protein if only they could digest it. And the ones who could, they lived and had babies, and that's who survived.
You've done your research. So the last two major evolutionary changes that you've seen in humans, which were about 12,000 years ago, were adult lactase persistence. It occurred in two regions. One was Scandinavian region. So if your true ancestry comes from Scandinavian countries, you can probably handle dairy as an adult. And then there were a couple small regions in Africa. And it was protective against malaria, because malaria was a major condition about 12,000 years ago. The other major evolutionary change was blonde hair, blue eyes. So people who come that have a strong heritage from those regions, you might be able to tolerate as an adult. But there's still plenty of issues with dairy. And look, I eat cheese every once in a while. And again, you know, one thing I will say about any diet, put paleo diet aside, any diet, trying to be 100%, trying to be extremist, I always recommend against. Our bodies are designed to handle a certain level of stressors, a certain level of insult. You can have dairy every once in a while. You can, you know, we're certain that hunter-gatherer societies over those millions of years, every once in a while ate wheat, every once in a while ate grains. It just wasn't a major part of their diet. So unless you have an autoimmune condition where, or a disease where you know this is a trigger for you and you just have to remove it from your diet 100%, you can have a little. And that's what you're experiencing with the Greek yogurt. But, you know, other issues with dairy, it can really spike insulin, which you have to be careful about. Another thing, you hear people complain all the time. They're giving all these hormones to cows, and those hormones are getting into the milk, and that's really bad for you. They kind of have it right. It's not because of all the injections. Evolution had a really neat trick, which was, you don't want infants growing unless there is enough calories for them to grow. And in hunter-gatherer times, that would have been an issue. There were times where they just didn't have enough calories. So you want the infant to slow down its growth. The way evolution figured out how to handle this was, if the mother is not eating enough, if the mother is in a starvation state, then you want the infant to slow down its growth cycle. And so we don't, as a baby, as an infant that was just born, really produce our own growth hormones. They come from the mother's milk. So when the mother is eating enough and can feed this infant in a way that it can grow, then you start getting the hormones in the mother's milk, and the infant will grow. So hormones naturally exist in milk. And one of the issues we have with dairy is we are consuming the hormones from another animal. And they do have a negative impact on us. They are inflammatory.
Meaning our immune system recognizes it as other?
As foreign. It can spark some types of growth in us, but not ones that you, particularly as an adult, you want to see, and your body's really well equipped for. So, and I'm trying not to dive too deep into the science here, but happy to go deeper if you'd like.
Yeah. Well, so in the end, I'm gonna ask you for some what are the resources that people can get access to so that they can, you know, look into this further, because I think that there's no doubt that this, you know, eating a whole food diet, lots of plants, is important to our health. You can't outrun a bad diet, is what. We've been saying for a long time. As I was preparing for this, if anybody had asked me what my diet was, I'd have said vegetarian. But it turns out that I'm pretty much paleo, sort of without really trying to. And the reason for me not eating many grains, I do eat steel-cut oatmeal, but the reason that I don't eat any bread or any pasta is that it's just too many calories for what I could get out of it. And I never undereat bread or pasta. I always overeat bread or pasta. So it's just like having brownies around the house. It's all bad things come of having that around. And the milk, I'm lactose intolerant. So, I can't even eat ice cream, really.
Yep.
It's just the yogurts, I guess it there's so much less of the milk sugar in it. And the Greek yogurt I always liked because it was higher protein. Mm-hmm. But still, even you know, as we already mentioned, if I was eating it every day, I was feeling like achy joint issues. And when I cut it out, I feel much better. And so, you know, but I love it so much that I added in, you know, a little a cherry on top of my diet, but it can't be a fundamental part of my diet or I get this inflammatory effect that you were describing. But it would seem to me that the other thing that is true about, you know, if we talk about eat like a caveman kind of a thing, there were other things other than, you know, they didn't have milk and they didn't have, you know, access to processed grains and beans in a way that was, that would keep them from making us sick. They had all kinds of other things that mm-hmm. we evolved with, you know, the people that did these things survived better and that's who we came from. So they had a ton of variety, I would think. Maybe, you know, maybe not every mm-hmm. single day, you know, but certainly seasonally. No caveman in history had blueberries every day for their whole life.
Yes.
So, you know, seasonal variation, you hear that from a lot of different people who aren't trying to talk about paleo.
Yeah.
But it just makes sense that you would do that. One of the things that I'm doing right now as sort of an experiment is that I'm trying not to eat anything 2 days in a row.
Yep.
I'm moving my diet around every single day. And I've a long time had a goal of 40 plants a week. And that comes from the American Gut Project. Anyway, mm-hmm. I haven't read up on that in a while. So maybe my mind has created 40, maybe it was 30. But anyway, 40 plants a week is what I'm after. Now, that's not 40 plants a day. That would be impossible. But 40 plants a week, which I still haven't actually achieved, but I've gotten pretty close. You know, that would be anything. It could be spices and herbs and things like that. But the whole thing that drives me toward, and I'm interested in your thoughts on it, is that it forces me to have different things all the time. Because mm-hmm. otherwise, you can't possibly get that many different things into your diet in a week. And so, you know, it just seems like I'm even though I could eat any crappy thing every day of my life when I was 15 to 25, maybe 35, well, I can't anymore. It's my, you know, my defenses are not as good. My repair mechanism is not as good as it was. So I have to be more mindful of not throwing too much at my body all at the same time. What do you think?
Yeah. So love that you brought that up. And I agree 100%. I think diversity is really important. Something that I hate is when people talk about, oh, this superfood or that superfood and have this all the time, you're going to be incredibly healthy. Because I don't believe there's such a thing as one superfood. Mm-hmm. Yeah, kale's great for you. Eat kale all the time, you're going to have negative health impacts. it's just one of many foods that you should eat, and you should have that variety. I had some really enjoyable conversations with this researcher, Dr. London, who's been going down to South America and spending time with one of the last remaining hunter-gatherer societies in the world. And something he brought up in his research that I found really fascinating is exactly like you said, they eat a huge variety of fruit. They actually don't eat a ton of vegetables. They eat mostly fruit and meat. And he said they can sense the phytochemical contents in the fruit.
They can sense it.
They can sense it. You know, I've kind of drilled in of how they sense it. It's like, you know, we can smell the fruit. It's kind of a sense like that. That we've lost. And they have a huge variety of fruits around them, but they will only eat particular fruits when they can sense the high phytochemical content. So even though the fruits, you know, they're right on the equator, these fruits are mostly available all year round, but they still have a seasonality and they will still eat only certain fruits at certain times of year. So, you know, I love your recommendation. I think that's a great one for people to follow. You know, the one I give to people is, do eat seasonal fruits. Eat them when they're fresh and in season and keep having that variety. So strawberries are great. Don't necessarily eat strawberries all year round. That's not great. Mm. So keep having that variety and change it up. So lot of different ways to do that, but I fully agree.
Oh, great. So other things that, as I was thinking about, you know, if I was to go live out in the wild, you know, and I couldn't go to the grocery store and, you know, I maybe I could make a fire, but, you know, I didn't have blenders and all the things that, you know, air fryers and all things like that. You know, what would my life be like in, you know, food in my life? Well, I'd be eating whatever I could get. So that drives a lot of variation, but it also drives that some days I didn't get enough and some days I found extra and I probably ate too much, you know, more than I needed. By too much, I mean more than I needed that day. But, you know, it would be nice to have some fat storage so that I wouldn't like fall down and die the one day I couldn't get enough food. So not having the same amount of food every single day, everything seems to be, you know, if you think about even like cycling, you know, your training regimes are, they go in cycles. You know, you work out really hard and then you have to recover. And so that would be like maybe a daily kind of a cycle. And then you've got these longer cycles as you're like base training and then you're trying to peak for a race. And, you know, nothing in the universe, well, let's just say nothing with human beings is flat where it's the same every single day, except maybe sleep, because the earth rotates on its axis once a day.
Yep. So again, love that you bring that up. So if you listen to our show, you know that I'm a big fan of the polarized approach to training.
Yeah.
And I wrote a whole article about the fact that the polarized training is the method that most closely emulates how hunter-gatherers live their lives.
Oh.
They didn't train. Like, they didn't go, I need to go get exercise. It was just their lifestyle. And when they, on days when they went out for the hunt, they would walk, run a marathon. It was a long day. And so they were very physically fit people. But they would have a hunt day where they'd walk, run a marathon, and then the next day they'd rest. They wouldn't do that every single day.
Right.
But as you pointed out, they didn't have refrigeration. You know, once you had the hunt or you gathered berries or whatever it was that you were eating, you had to eat it pretty quickly or it would go bad.
Yeah.
So there would be some days when they could really feast. You had a successful hunt, they would eat a ton. You would have days where they would have to really cut back because they just didn't have that much food. And so again, that's been one of the arguments for that sort of concept of intermittent fasting. You had a lot of European explorers who encountered hunter-gatherer societies for the first time and recorded their behavior. And the other thing you saw was they didn't eat three meals a day. What was actually amazing is they would get up, eat nothing, or maybe have a very small snack, go walk, run this marathon. And then they would come back and they would have one giant meal right around kind of 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon. So they would snack a little bit through the day, but they'd actually only eat one meal. So this idea of the three square meals is really a modern concept. It's not the way our ancestors lived.
Yeah, I heard that the breakfast being the most important meal comes from a cereal commercial.
Yeah, yeah.
So isn't that awesome?
Hunter-gatherer societies didn't do that. What I love is these accounts from these Western explorers who, you know, you would think of as being very fit, very tough people. They would get made fun of by these hunter-gatherer societies because they'd have to eat in the morning and hunter-gatherers look at them and go, what's your problem?
That's funny. You know, it is true though that your hunger seems to come from just your habitual eating times. Mm-hmm. It has nothing to do with whether you need energy or not. It's just, oh, you normally eat now, so I'm going to turn the hunger signal on.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you as a cyclist, that was one of the things I noticed when I switched my diet. So, you know, when I was racing full time, I was eating a very standard Western diet. I was eating, you know, the classic sports nutrition. And if I went out for a 6-hour bike ride, like I would have to eat 1,000 calories before that ride, and I would have to be eating constantly through that ride. Mm-hmm. And I still recommend that. You need to fuel during a ride. There are consequences of doing that on your performance. But after I went paleo, I noticed if I wasn't paying attention, I could go out for a 6-hour ride and basically not eat on the ride, and I would not notice.
Interesting. That sounds like somebody, that sounds like my personal experience when I did keto. Yeah. I was just very fat adapted, and I didn't bring food with me anymore when I went on my bike rides, because I was fine all day long. I quit it because when you have to go uphill, my legs were dead. You know, I didn't have the second gear.
As I said, I'm not going to recommend it because it's going to affect your performance. And that's a whole different conversation. Yeah. But I did find that when you're keto, obviously, you're keeping your insulin levels much more regulated, much more controlled. When I was eating that traditional sports nutrition diet, you know, my insulin was up, down, up, down, up, down. So you had to constantly be eating, or the insulin would plummet and your energy would just go through the floor. So you had to do that to keep yourself going.
Interesting. So what about things like, again, me thinking about myself living out in the wild, you know, I probably would not, you know, if I found some carrots, say, you know, probably a natural carrot would not be very appealing to me now, but let's just say I found some carrot-like things and I was going to eat them. I'd be tempted to just eat them raw, right? And it would be like good chewing. It'd be healthy for my teeth, getting some stress on my teeth as well. You know, is there any of that, you know, like the rawness of the food, or, you know, any of these other things?
So this gets into, I love this conversation too, cost-benefit analysis. Uh-huh. And it's another criticism we've had of the paleo diet, which I go with a fair criticism. But again, let's look at the cost-benefits because, for example, we give recommendations on cooking oil. They would have pointed out the fact that hunter-gatherer societies never use cooking oil. So if you want to be true paleo, you shouldn't. I read a great study by a researcher who was trying to figure out how hunter-gatherers ate meat before they had fire. So that they did that for a long time. And so he actually experimented on himself just eating raw meat. And he basically said you almost had to eat it like chewing gum because it would take you forever to break down and chew this meat. And I look at that and go, you know, good on you for trying that and actually doing it yourself.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to recommend that to people. So yes, there's these whole raw movements. And I think fruits and vegetables, eating them raw is great. Or just minimizing the cooking. Or if you do cook them on lower temperatures. That's what I do. I like to saute them on low temperatures. Meat, I'm not going to recommend to anybody unless you go to a good sushi restaurant to eat that raw. So, you know, things that did exist back then, you know, no, they weren't invincible people. The biggest cause of death back then were diseases. And a lot of that's because they were eating a lot of raw food. So there are health benefits to the raw side, but there's also, there can be bacteria. There can be all sorts of things in that, those meats and those foods that you don't want to consume that you kill by cooking. So again, cost benefit, I'd rather cook.
Yeah, I get it. Although I do eat a ton of carrots and celery raw.
So do I, yeah.
I just have gotten to where I love it. Now, they didn't have supplements back, 20,000 years ago either. But, you know, they probably ate all kinds of things that we would never think of eating, you know, like bugs or, you know, tree bark or, you know, things like that. Organ meats. Mm-hmm. I mean, I haven't had organ. I had liver, I think, once as a kid, which, you know, I was terrified of it. It actually didn't taste bad to me. But I never want and I never eat organ meats anymore. So anyway, or bone marrow or brains or so. Are there any supplements that are sort of consistent with the paleo diet to compensate for the fact that we don't eat hardly any of these things that no doubt our ancestors did eat?
Yeah. So yes, absolutely. And that's been kind of an evolution of the paleo diet. Dr. Cordain in his first book basically said no supplements.
Okay.
We have debated this every single year and we're moving towards, there are some supplements that are good for your health, but you have to be careful. You have to do it in moderation. So the most important thing that I'm going to bring up here is it is not about more is better. And Western society is really more is better. So, you know, you go to a supplement store and everything is super and mega, you know, this has more of this of it, so it's got to be better for you. That's not how the human body works. What drives our body is homeostasis, balance. And we are supposed to eat our foods in balance. And when you talk about the nutrients we need, we actually need them in particular ratios. And so I can go into dozens of ratios, but the three most important in our body, sodium-potassium ratio. We should be eating 5-to-1 potassium to sodium, if not up to 10-to-1. Western diet is 1-to-2.
So you're saying we should be eating more potassium than sodium?
Far more potassium than sodium. And on a Western diet, we eat more sodium than potassium. Right. And for any women listening to this, there are now dozens and dozens and dozens of studies showing that that is a major factor in osteoporosis.
Really?
So you have all these women that are supplementing with calcium, which there's, you know, the research shows that at best has a mild impact on osteoporosis. But I'd say there's probably, I've at least seen 20, 30 studies where they take osteoporotic women, take them off their calcium supplement, put them on the potassium supplement, and start regrowing bone tissue.
Wow. So I guess people just, whatever their thoughts on, all of what we've been talking about, they should be using, if they're going to eat salt, they should be eating a salt substitute that's got potassium in it instead of sodium, or maybe more potassium.
Yeah. More importantly, eat fruits, eat lots of vegetables, particularly green leafy vegetables. Those are your best sources of potassium.
Oh, okay, good.
So, and that gets to the second ratio that's really important, which is calcium to magnesium. And tons of research showing we should be eating about 2-to-1 calcium to magnesium. Western diet is close to 4-to-1, and a lot of women are over 4-to-1. And tons of research showing that when you have too high a calcium to magnesium ratio, that contributes to heart disease. And that's one of the explanations for why women are now matching men in heart disease. It used to be far more men had heart disease. See, unfortunately, all these women, they're going to the doctors, doctors are recommending a calcium supplement. Not really helping the osteoporosis, but it is increasing their risk of heart disease. Likewise, too low a ratio, you drop below about 1.7-to-1, and again, you see that associated with heart disease. So it's really important to get that right ratio of calcium to magnesium. The other important ratio is omega-3 to omega-6. And we get too much omega-6, not enough omega-3, and we need to get more omega-3. Sorry to go on that tangent, but these ratios are really important to our body. So when you supplement, you have to be careful that you're not throwing a ratio way out of whack, like that calcium to magnesium ratio. So supplements I would recommend, definitely vitamin D, because a lot of us don't get enough sun. Omega-3s, I think, are a great supplement.
And omega-3s, do you mean EPA and DHA?
Yes, or? So get the fish oils.
Okay.
And that's one where that omega-3, omega-6 ratio is really important, but they haven't really shown any evidence that the ratio can get too high. Meaning you start having issues if you have too much omega-6 to omega-3, but if you have, there isn't really too much omega-3 to omega-6.
Okay.
So omega-3 is a great supplement. Some people do need to supplement with magnesium because they get too much calcium, especially, so that goes back to our dairy question. Milk is 20-to-1 calcium to magnesium. So if you're consuming a lot of dairy, you're getting too much calcium, and you're not getting nearly enough magnesium. So some people do need to supplement with magnesium.
Very interesting. Yeah. I recently have adopted taking a fairly decent dose of magnesium at night for sleep. Which I thought would also help. And a recent blood test showed that I was low on magnesium, which kills me because I've been, off and on supplementing magnesium forever. And it's like, now I'm low on magnesium. How the heck? All right. So, good. So good tips on that.
Very quickly, last one I'll throw at you that some people should consider is taurine, particularly vegans. Because you can only get taurine from animal sources, particularly seafood. Very interesting studies on cats, which are obligate carnivores. Unfortunately, I have a lot of people who are vegans who have owned cats, and they go, well, I'm going to put my cat on a vegan diet. And their studies showing the cats end up going blind.
Oh, my gosh.
Because they don't get enough taurine, and taurine is critical for our eye health.
Oh, very interesting. Yeah, the taurine has been in the news a lot lately. So good tip on that one. Well, and so one last thing, and then we'll start to wrap up. The bit about, you know, me now living out in the wild and having to find my own food. You know, I would be getting plenty of exercise. You know, I would be earning my food. And it seems to me that, you know, one of the things that, you know, people talk about, oh, high protein is bad for you, and, you know, protein restriction extends life. I still have not been able to get convinced that the lowest possible protein, you know, people like Walter Longo, they're talking like 0.3 and 0.4 grams per pound of body weight. I mean, they're at, you know, below the RDA, which, you know, you talk to, you know, people who are protein believers, they're like, oh, it should be 1 gram per pound of body weight. But it seems to me that the missing piece that explains it is, you know, if you're sort of sedentary, or maybe you walk a lot, then yeah, okay, you could probably do with a lot less protein. But if you are an exercising person, which is probably healthier to exercise vigorously, I mean, very vigorously a little bit, and, you know, and more than walking a decent amount, and walking is fine too. You know, I think walking is great for mental health and enjoying the beauty of nature and getting some sunshine, but it's not really exercise. So if a person is getting plenty of exercise, then, you know, that drives them to needing more protein, I think, that then they can get just from plants. And so, you know, it's making me, I still have not been able to get myself to believe that I want to be vegetarian, or, you know, or very, very low protein. What are your thoughts on the protein question?
Yeah. So, you know, first of all, glad you brought up exercise. I do not believe somebody can be healthy without vigorous exercise. You know, there's always that debate of, is it diet or exercise? And I hate that debate because it's both. You can't be healthy without both. But this goes back to why I don't like simplifying down to carbohydrates, protein, and fat. And I'll give you an analogy. I'm going to make a ridiculous statement right now. Broccoli is bad for you, because broccoli is a carbohydrate. Skittles are a carbohydrate. Skittles are bad for you. Therefore, broccoli is bad for you. You go, that's just a stupid argument. But that's the argument we make with protein. We lump all protein together, and they are not all the same. There are different quality proteins, and the variance is as big as Skittles and broccoli. And so you have these people that, you know, we do studies on protein and its impact on your health. Protein is expensive. Researchers often don't have a lot of money. So how do they do the study on high protein? They give you a ton of whey protein. And I can have a very long conversation with you right now about all the negative effects on whey protein. But, you know, there's a Bible for vegans, and that's the China study written by Dr. T. Colin Campbell. And he showed how animal protein could basically cause cancer. But what he was doing studies on mice. What he was feeding the mice was whey protein. And whey protein comes from dairy. It is a very low quality protein. And so that's some of this research that you're seeing saying, oh, protein's really bad for you. They're feeding this really low quality protein that we know is bad for your health. So it is about the quality of the protein. And when you see people eating a higher protein diet from high quality protein, so coming from you know, grass-fed animals, coming from seafood, healthy seafood, you're seeing all sorts of positive health impacts on their health. You know, here's one that blows people's minds. You know, you keep seeing this red meat is bad for your health, bad for your heart. A lot of that research was done with people that were eating McDonald's.
Oh, gosh.
So now they're finally separating, and I can send you studies where they had people eating a higher quantity of red meat, but it was grass-fed, pasture-raised meat. And they show that that red meat is actually protective of their heart.
Well, that surely is different from what you hear you know, out on the internet. So that is very interesting. So normally when people talk about the quality of a protein, they're talking about like the branched chain amino acid content of it. And you're not saying that. You're saying what other stuff is in the protein.
Right. I'm talking about the source of the protein.
the matrix, I guess. And some proteins are processed, salami, types of things. That's not going to be good for you. But I had not actually ever heard. So I'm interested in, if we can afford a few more minutes.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm interested in understanding, why is whey bad for you? Because whey is the standard. As you say, any protein study that anybody has ever done has been with whey.
Well, you've heard my concerns with dairy. Whey protein.
Or casein, which is this, the opposite of the same thing.
Yeah, but it all comes from dairy. Yeah. And you're going to have those hormones in it. I'm not going to go into scientific terms, but it can spike insulin.
Okay.
It has just a variety of negative health impacts. And again,
because it's just an unnatural thing, you're saying. The body reacts to it differently.
Yep. Well, I mean, I love the fact, so share a story with you. Back at the height, so the paleo diet, Dr. Cordain's original book and the China study came out at about the same time. So they were both hugely popular and obviously very different perspectives on dietary approach. And Dr. Cordain and Dr. Campbell were at a conference at the same time, and the organizers went, well, we got to take advantage of this opportunity and asked the two of them to have a debate. And anybody who knows Dr. Cordain knows how he's going to approach a debate. He showed up with a stack of research that was about a foot tall. Dr. Cordain doesn't walk anywhere without his studies. And so as they're having the debate, Dr. Campbell was bringing up all of his research. Well, I saw this in mice. I saw that in mice. And Dr. Cordain was pulling out studies going, well, this study shows this, this study shows that. And they were getting kind of frustrated with one another. And finally, Dr. Cordain goes, well, let's talk about your study. Because you're right. In that study, he was feeding casein, but it was basically protein that came from dairy. And he goes, the primary proteins that we eat from animals are actin and myosin from muscle meat, not casein. So first of all, if you're going to make statements in general about meat and animal protein, why didn't you do your studies on actin and myosin on meat? Mm-hmm. He goes, second of all, you were feeding these mice a quantity of this whey protein for humans to consume that, if you scaled up to human size, they'd have to drink like 2 gallons of dairy a day.
Doesn't sound likely.
Which is too much. So Dr. Cordain goes, look, I absolutely agree with you that this source of protein is horribly bad for you, but you can't make general statements from that about all animal protein.
Ah, okay.
So it was a very interesting debate. And, basically Dr. Campbell did all the research showing that these proteins sources, the most common that you supplement with that come from dairy have huge negative impacts. He definitely proved that. And Dr. Cordain didn't argue with that. He just says you can't take that and apply it to all animal protein.
Interesting. Well, I have to say that I did have an episode with, not with Dr. Longo, but with the CEO of Prolon, who does the fasting mimicking diet. And after talking to him, I had been convinced that I wanted to get my protein intake lower. And the way I was going to do it was to stop supplementing with whey and just get my protein in with my fish or, which is mostly what else I would, eggs, that sort of thing. And I have not really succeeded in that, but you're making me think I need to redouble my efforts on that, because the idea is not to go low protein anyway, not for me, because I just feel like I need it. I need a decent amount of protein in order to recover, and I am still trying to build muscle with some success. I just feel better when I am doing that. I just don't think I think I can get enough from the animal proteins that is not the milk. And the thing is that the milk proteins are great for building muscle. It really is great. And why not? It's milk that was designed to make baby cows become big cows.
Yep.
So it should promote growth. That's what it's designed for. So, you know, the question is promoting growth like that generally everywhere in my body a good thing or not? I want bigger muscles, but I don't necessarily want every part of my body having a growth stimulus all the time by having, you know, a whey shake every or several times a day, every day of my life. So you've made me think that I really have got to get back to that. So thanks for that.
So you bring up a really good point that, yes, if you're a bodybuilder and you're trying to put on a ton of muscle mass, whey protein is a great way to do it. But this, so I always have the conversation about performance versus health. And that is performance enhancing. It's not necessarily great for your health. And I will say similar things about cyclists. And so look, you know, we talked about some of the hormones that you find in dairy. So, you know, one of our biggest growth hormones in our body is insulin-like growth factor. And it's called insulin-like growth factor because it behaves very much like insulin. And so when you're consuming a lot of this, a lot of these foods, you're spiking the insulin-like growth factor. You're also spiking insulin.
Yeah.
Dr. Cordain wrote a paper on this a while ago that, you know, people who do research in acne have since come to him and said, thank you for writing that paper, showing that the cause of acne is really insulin binding to the basolateral side of our epithelial cells, right? So basically insulin binding to the body side of your skin cells. And they can cause inflammation. And that inflammation then will cause infection in hair follicles, and then you get acne. And something I have noticed is when you see, so I'll talk about bodybuilders, I'm also going to talk about cyclists who eat a lot of these foods. You see in bodybuilders when they're bulking up, they have a lot of acne. But I, as a professional cyclist, I remember going to races and looking at these 20-something kids take their jerseys off, and their chest and back are also covered with acne. And it's because they're spiking all this insulin and they're causing these inflammatory responses, and it shows on their skin.
Wow. All right, Trevor, this has been really good. And we obviously could keep going.
Yeah.
But in the interest of time here, why don't you tell us how we can find more information about you, about the paleo diet, maybe some of these studies that you've been referring to?
Yeah. I would say come to our website. It's thepaleodiet.com. It's easy to find. We have a lot of articles there. We have a lot written by Dr. Cordain. And if you read any of his studies, you'll see it will have a reference list of 60, 70 articles. He just loves his research. So if you want to read some of this research, look at that. I try to provide references as well. I always recommend, Dr. Cordain wrote several books, The Paleo Diet, The Paleo Diet for Athletes. And we actually have a book coming out this fall called Paleo for Life, which was looking at the impact of diet on longevity. So if people are interested in the paleo diet, I would say those are the starting points. And, you know, as a scientist myself, I always recommend, you know, go to PubMed, do the hunt, find the research. It's, I don't ever want to make a statement where you can't go back to peer-reviewed research and say, you know, here's the proof. I'm not just pulling this out of my butt.
There we go. All right, Trevor. Hey, man, I really appreciate it. Thanks for this and for, you know, all the other stuff you're doing.
I appreciate it. I really enjoyed the conversation, Joe. Thank you.
All righty. Have a good one. Bye-bye.
You too.
Thank you for joining my conversation with Trevor Connor about the paleo diet. You can find more information in the show notes.